Rocking the WTO, Day 2. You're listening to a special report prepared by Rock the WTO Radio, an initiative of indie media activists converging in Montreal. We are preparing daily reports to document the dissent and alternative visions that are being mobilized in response to the World Trade Organization's many ministerial meetings in Montreal. This report is from Day 2. About 24 trade ministers have attended the exclusive mini-ministerial meeting in Montreal, which opened on Monday, July 28th. Those who gathered in the streets of Montreal to oppose this round of trade talks are drawing concerns to a number of issues being ravaged on the table at the World Trade Organization. Since its inception in 1994, the WTO has continued to expand its tentacle-like reach into our communities, seeking more and more markets to exploit. Social needs like food, medicine, and education are often treated as commodities to be exploited within the WTO's agenda. For many, this agenda has deadly repercussions for the world's most needy. While the WTO continues to put barriers on the production of generic HIV and AIDS medications, millions around the world die. While demonstrating outside of the WTO mini-ministerial, participants reflected on the threat this organization poses to social services like medicine.
Why are you part of this snake march today?
We're protesting the WTO based on their unfair policies in terms of generic medications to the developing world. HIV/AIDS is a huge problem right now, and based on people not getting the drugs that they need, people are dying. And this is basically solely on WTO policies. So, therefore, we have to protest this right now. That's why we're here.
What has been the change of WTO policies over the last few years, especially since Seattle?
Pardon me?
What has been the change of WTO policies, or at least rhetoric, since Seattle?
They have actually a written policy which supports generic medications and supports the rights of developing world people. But the bigger countries are bullying the smaller countries and not actually agreeing to it. The USA, the EU, Canada, they've all signed on to this agreement called the Doha Accord. But they actually haven't actually gone through with it. They're not letting the countries import the cheap medications. And they're still forcing the expensive medications upon them. So it's not really working.
And sorry, what's your background?
I'm a medical student. And I'm interested in the issue. I'm a concerned citizen as well.
Thank you very much. And I'm speaking with...
Oline.
Okay.
And independent activist.
And you're doing your master's right now in what?
Yeah. I'm looking at the intersection between intellectual property rights under international trade agreements and global health, in particular access to medicine for people living with AIDS and social movements.
And why are you involved with the Snake March today?
Well, the Snake March is really interesting. I mean, it's really distinct from the march that happened yesterday, because this is a group of people that categorically reject the WTO as a way to organize the economy around the world. So, for example, in the issues that I work on, there are a lot of people fighting to tweak the TRIPS agreement so that people can have access to medicine. But when you put that aside and you take a step back and you look at the bigger picture, 97% of the patents in the world are owned by companies in the global north. So even if the agreement allowed for access to medicine, there's still this funneling of basically resources and funds from the south to the north, which is sort of a bigger problem that people need to look at. So I think that there's always a part of society that categorically will say, well, that is wrong. It's wrong that there should be people that are extremely rich that make the kind of profits that, say, pharmaceutical companies make, while there are people in the world that are starving or dying who don't have access to medicine.
And what has WTO responded since Seattle? What have they done?
Well, since Seattle, there was another round of negotiations launched in Doha, Qatar, at the meetings in 2001. And the Doha round of negotiations is supposed to be a quote-unquote development round. It's supposed to be for the global south to get them engaged in economic development and get them engaged in the global economy. But it's really problematic. It seems like the meetings in Montreal that are happening here today and tomorrow July 28th and 29th, are a rescue mission for Cancun. Cancun is the next ministerial meeting in September. And there's been very little agreement in many, many areas of the negotiations between countries in the north and countries in the south. In particular, one of the bigger issues is on agriculture. The fact that the United States and the EU heavily subsidize their local agricultural industries, and that makes it very difficult for the southern countries to get access to any kind of markets because they're competing with these huge subsidies that farmers here are getting. So it's unfair competition, even by the WTO rules. So they're trying to change that, but they can't agree on how to do it. They can't agree on how to allow countries to export generic medicines produced under compulsory licensing to countries that need those medicines in the south. And it's just it's interesting to me that in the round that's supposed to be about development, they can't come to an agreement on it. So they've had to create this meeting that's totally outside of the traditional structures and meeting system of the WTO, just to rescue what's going to happen in Cancun, because they haven't agreed on anything. And if they don't agree on it here, they're not going to agree on it in September. So it's a really important meeting for activists to pay attention to in terms of what happens, because it will affect whether or not the southern countries, and it'll show whether or not the southern countries at the negotiating tables are going to engage, or whether they're going to do as they did in Seattle, which was turn around and say, actually, this isn't working for us, and we're not going to play this game.
There's some representatives from some non-governmental organizations at some of the meetings today. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, the representatives that are meeting with Supachai, who's the chair of the WTO Ministerial Council, are meeting with him to talk about a range of issues that are affecting developing countries right now. So the thinking behind that is that you have to engage. In Canada, it's a responsibility of them to engage, to let them know what the NGO community is thinking in terms of how to bring fair trade to the WTO, which it hasn't done a very good job of. And in terms of a broader social movement idea, I mean, there are a lot of people at this march right here who would fundamentally disagree with that engagement, who would say, by engaging, you're complicit in the impacts of the WTO on the global south. And by being complicit in that, you're not helping. But I think it's really important for the movement to engage at every level. And every piece that all activists are doing is really important. So the people on the streets are going to apply pressure to those NGOs to think really critically about what they're doing, to think very critically in terms of justifying, is the question a fix-it or nix-it question with the WTO? Should we be tweaking it or should we be trashing it and starting with something new? And those NGOs need to think very critically about the messaging that they bring to people like Supachai when they meet with them. And they have to be accountable to this group of people here who are going to question them in terms of what they're asking for and what they're getting. And the really important thing is what they're getting. If they go to a meeting there and they don't get anything out of that meeting, or there's no impact of that meeting, then there's a group of people already organized for them to say, okay, well, if this engagement isn't working, it's time for us to do something more confrontational. And whether or not that will happen will remain to be seen as per what comes out of the meetings. And in what happens in Cancun in September, on the streets and in the meetings, is going to be a result of the outcomes here in Montreal.
And I guess just quickly, if you could just overview the huge problem that has to do with health and the international development issue in WTO. I just wondering if you could just give a quick overview of that, if that's even possible.
Okay. There's an agreement under the WTO called the TRIPS Agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. And the TRIPS Agreement covers patent protection. And under the WTO, you can apply, all countries have to be complicit to WTO rules on patent protection. And patents are offered for 20 years on drugs, medicines. And what that means is that the 20 years of patent protection means that a company will have a monopoly on a drug for 20 years before it is open up for generic companies to make copies and becomes open to price competition on the markets. So it's a very, very long period of time before drugs can become more affordable and accessible to other countries. And aside from that, there's also problems in terms of the way that the TRIPS agreement is organized. The ministers can't agree on whether or not countries that are unable to produce their own drugs, whether or not they should be able to import them from other countries that can produce them for cheap. So Brazil, for example, has an excellent health system for people living with AIDS. The government produces all of the drugs under compulsory, in some cases under compulsory licensing, although they haven't begun to invoke TRIPS for that yet. But in a lot of cases, just by generic companies to keep the drugs cheap. And by doing that, they've managed to offer treatment to people living with AIDS. But what they can't do is export those drugs to other countries that don't have the ability to make them, because the WTO rules won't allow for it. They won't allow for that kind of competition to happen on the global market. And at the Doha meeting in 2001, the ministers all agreed and came out with this Doha Declaration on Public Health, the TRIPS Agreement on Public Health, that the trade agreement on intellectual property rights should not inhibit governments from protecting public health. But they wouldn't agree on that issue. And they agreed to come to an agreement on that issue by the end of 2002. And when their own deadline came around, they still hadn't agreed on it, because the interests of the pharmaceutical industries were very strong in informing the negotiating position, particularly in the United States, but in a lot of the wealthier countries as well. Canada, of course, we always sort of follow in tow what the United States does. And so since they haven't met their own negotiating deadline, with AIDS alone, let alone any other communicable disease, over 1.5 million people have died because they're not meeting these deadlines. And people are just dying, which is another reason why, you know, people on the streets today, you just have to ask yourself, there have been NGOs engaging on this issue for years, and people are still dying every day. Why are we allowing that to happen? Why do we tolerate that of our own government and of this organization? It's not acceptable. We have the medicine so that people can live lives when they're living with AIDS. We know how to do it. People should have access to those medicines. It's almost a no-brainer. So the agreement makes medicine expensive and unaffordable, and it also makes it difficult for countries to access them in terms of exporting and importing. So there's a lot of pressure coming from NGOs. Some of the NGOs meeting with the Super Chat today are also going to be talking about that issue, and we'll see how far they get with it, and we'll see what kind of solution they come up with. They've prepped themselves to come up with what I would call a weak solution, which is a solution that requires developing countries to submit to the WTO that they are going to apply for a license to import the drugs for this long, for these specific drugs, which is a really weak solution, because under the agreement, rich countries and countries that are able to manufacture their own drugs can just use what's called a compulsory license to manufacture generic drugs if they need it. The United States does it all the time, not specifically for drugs, but for lots of other things. And the poorer countries that don't have the capacity can't do that right now. If a strong solution would be a solution that is amends the actual agreement itself to allow for basically any country to have the exact same rights to do the same thing. So if they didn't have the capacity, they could import the drugs should they need them. And that's not the kind of solution they're going for. And if they do agree on something, it is going to be a weak solution, and they're going to announce it as a success and a victory. And it's not going to be. It's not going to be a victory for people living with AIDS, because they're going to continue to die, because they're not going to have access to the drugs. So
thank you very much.
No problem.
Well, I guess the main concern in our workshop was that education was being treated as a service by the Liberal government, and also especially other governments around the world, in a place that could be education, healthcare, other social services be treated as commodities and be exploited services, so that profits can be extracted from them, and instead of like providing something that, you know, helps people around the world. Education is being limited by them, and they're attempting to create a system where it's going to be even less accessible. Education will be even less accessible around the world because the profit motive will be there, which means that costs for education will increase.
In addition to medicine, the World Trade Organization's policies also impact local concerns like education. At the Words on Weapons teach-in, held prior to the mini-ministerial, the Canadian Students' Federation discussed the future of education if treated as a commodity to be exploited by the WTO. The discussion also looked at the profits currently being reaped from the corporatization of education.
So one of the major problems, just like Helen was saying, is a further corporatization of education. In the United States, what happened back in 1994 was 500 American universities decided to, their websites, they decided to go with one company called, it's called a Campus Pipeline. And basically they're a web portal. It's a one web page that you go to that gives you links to everything that a student would need, to the university, to search engines, to research material, things like that. And 500 different, that itself is a lucrative business. Yahoo and Google and companies like that, they make a lot of money off of doing that. But the thing they find hard, especially because the money they get is from advertising, is to make sure people keep coming back to them. Because you might go to Yahoo once, you might go to Google another time, you might do something else. But with 500 universities going to one portal, and these students have to go to that portal. You don't have a choice of going to something else. And so if they have advertising on their site, essentially they're guaranteeing these companies that advertise access to students in 500 universities across the United States. And so they're assured, and that's a lot of money. And it plays again into what Carolyn and Phil were saying about, as governments stop funding universities, as governments pull back, as they say, well, you know, we don't have the money anymore because then we'd have to raise taxes, you know, and they continue to see in the United States and Canada, everybody's talking just about cutting taxes. And so they're saying we don't have money, so the companies are coming in saying, well, we'll do this for you. We'll give you a portal, you know, and they can provide this to the university. It's not very expensive to provide it because all the money they make off is through advertising. But at the same time, anything the university posts on these web portals, on their websites, and this is happening in Canada too now, becomes property of the university, and through the contracts with the businesses that set up these websites, it becomes partially their property too. In York University, not too long ago, there was a major, major teacher strike. And the reason they did that was because they were trying to bring in regulations where any teacher's materials posted to a website became the material of the university and theirs to sell. Whatever a teacher used in their classroom was still theirs. But anything posted to the website, now we might say not every class has a website, but the push is there at Concordia, especially and most universities, every course has a website now. And anything posted there, the university can do with it as it likes. And so again, going back to Bombardier and going back to companies like that, they basically, that they're investing because they're getting free research. They have these relationships with the universities where any research we do doesn't go back out into the public sphere. And that's another thing that the WTO is doing through its intellectual property rights. It's pushing to have a more of a market for just intellectual, what you come up with, privatizing of information. And so, again, it's basically pushing to make sure anything you come up with, your thoughts, can be sold. And that they put a price on that and a price on everything. Another thing that they use is virtual university. Virtual U. And it's a conglomerate of, I'll just find the list of, because it's really mind-boggling, the companies involved here. It's in Canada, and it involves Kodak, IBM, Microsoft, McGraw-Hill, Prentice Hall, both of those are printing companies that print textbooks. Rogers Cable Systems, Unitel, Novasys, Nortel, Bell Canada, NPR Teltech, which is a subsidiary of a GTE, which is a major engineering firm. And so all these companies have gotten together to provide Virtual U, which is an online system, setting up a network where universities can provide their online courses. It provides the infrastructure for them to post their courses and have students. They post the chat rooms and bulletin boards you need to do this. And what part of the deal is that students going into this have to sign a contract before they can start the course. This is only in Canada. Other parts of the world, they don't have this law, but because it's private, students sign something saying, we allow companies to track where we go, to track what we say, to look at what we're doing in these courses. And along with that, there's advertising placed on the websites. And so essentially, they can track everything the students are doing and tailor their advertising to the students, so that basically they can keep track of what you're doing in your courses, and through that, they specify what advertising they give to you, and they work on what kind of marketing they even do outside of the classroom and in general across the world. And so it's a very insidious way of kind of getting in there and saying we're helping, but at the same time, it's very putting into the mind and putting ads right there and furthering their profits. It just keeps coming back to the money issue. And I think one thing that, especially in Canada and many places across the world, is that education isn't a money issue. It is something that isn't the reason that we're here, isn't, you know, so that one day we can be in a company and we make money off of people learning too. That's not what we do this for. You know, it's reasons that we have stuff like this to try to improve civil society and try to improve awareness and the equality of people. And so by further promoting this, they're just increasing profits. And another very cynical thing is just why would teachers, administrators, you know, want to do this? Because it's very obvious to them, they're signing the contracts for this, what happens. But more and more universities, like Phil was saying, that the Board of Governors is run by corporations. And so they don't think of it as an education system, they think of it as a profit system. And so 90% of universities' expenses come from faculties. 90% of what they talk about cutting in universities comes from faculties. So they're trying to cut as much as they can. A major expense they have is just supporting this classroom, of paying teachers, of paying for high schools and CJEPs, which are looking at busing people in to come to school if the schools provide buses to students. And so by eliminating the need for a school, these school administrators are essentially saving money. And as we saw at Concordia, most of the higher administrators just got major pay raises over the past few years. So by cutting the need to pay for universities, the actual buildings, to pay for teachers, to pay for textbooks, instead they can either save money and further enrich themselves as people who run the schools, or they can simply provide more services to corporations through their internet courses. And so it's very scary. Teachers themselves are speaking out against this. Some teachers, they provide it, provide these services because they don't have a choice, because the university says we're providing these online courses and your courses online this year. But especially as was shown with York and is shown with the Canadian Association of University Teachers, like Phil was saying, they've come out and spoken against this privatization, and because it directly affects them, because they're losing their jobs. Teachers are being, you know, laid off because of this, and it's just furthering, you know, just taking away from the actual education aspect of it and just feeding people like this information. It's not actually teaching. It's actually you sit there and you learn it yourself, and then you're ready to go off and work, and it's a very scary system that they have set up.
The concerns expressed in the streets over the WTO's threat to social services like education and medicine are valid concerns, but they are left excluded from the table. The ongoing disputes over agricultural subsidies is stalling negotiations within the WTO mini-ministerial, but any discussion on the impact of liberalizing food on family farmers and agricultural traditions around the world is also excluded. It is in the streets outside of the mini ministerial that these concerns were brought.
First, the WTO has had a lot of disputes within its internal body, aside from the dissent that we see here in the streets. And agriculture and food politics has been called its Achilles heel. So what do you guys think about that?
I mean, I think that the U.S. or big industrial nations are kind of faced with a hard task because we have, in here in Canada and the U.S., where I'm from, both places have a lot of subsidies. And while they call for, things like people lowering trade barriers in other countries, they, in the same like respect, place tariffs. So, I mean, agriculture is a hard thing because everyone wants food security, but yet they still consider it a good, which is very different than how, like, steel or something else.
Well, I come from a farm, so for me it's about being able to protect the right for individual family farms to be able to actually continue on and not have, like, the corporatization of farms, which the WTO and the neoliberal regime is suggesting, increasing the concentration of land ownership rather than allowing a large number of people to be able to create their own food, create their food for a nation, and control the distribution of food, really, as well.
And why is food an important issue, or agriculture an important issue for you today?
I mean, food is something, I mean, obviously, that we all need, and so it's important to me for that, but also the World Trade Organization, I think, has a lot of contradictory policies on food because of the way in which the policies that they implement hurt all farmers. It's not just a benefit for industrializations. And so, I mean, even the U.S. and Canada, in a pro-trade sense, don't have a stake in opening barriers for agricultural trade because it makes the food sources really insecure. So I think that's the main reason I'm here.
Well, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. So tell me about the sign that you have.
Well, I think there's a lot of good stuff that can come from trade and countries working together. But as long as that's fair trade, and you can see that through fair trade coffees, chocolates, teas, that kind of stuff. And there needs to be a lot more of that because, like, I think countries can work together, countries basically can work together, but too much dependence on the unequal grounds that it is now, such as smaller countries working with bigger countries, it's not fair. There's too much power in certain countries. Bigger countries use the smaller countries to take advantage of their exports and not pay them fairly and not give them fair wages.
Well, then why is Canada's trade minister calling it free trade?
It's free trade because they can basically access so many areas that they want. And so corporations, you know, they set up these free trade zones where they can, you know, trade without paying respect to the laws of that country. Which is obviously to their benefit for, lower wages and that kind of stuff.
And how do you think that the WTO impacts food policy or agriculture?
That's a huge part in it. I'm a huge fan of organic food and small farms and sort of feeding yourself and your community and the areas around you. And so they're more in favor of producing large crops and environmentally unfriendly crops with pesticides, GMOs, all that kind of stuff, in sort of all over the world to mass produce food at a lower cost, which I don't think is beneficial to humans' quality of life.
Well, the trade minister actually speaks a lot in various other representatives of the WTO as well as industrial agriculture about the benefits of GMOs and how they can solve a lot of the dire hunger situations in the world through GMOs. What do you think about that?
I think if it's going to solve hunger, then it's a very band-aid solution to hunger, because GMO crops, like, you need the seeds, you have to buy the seeds every year, you can't keep the seeds, and that's not traditional agriculture. And so you're going to solve hunger by getting, you know, third world countries in Africa, blah, 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 dependent on GMO seeds, which are produced in the richer countries. And I don't think that's solving hunger, because it's just creating more dependence. And I think people have farmed, like, people are alive in these areas for a reason, and they've managed to survive, I think, traditional agriculture.
You keep talking about dependence. It sounds like the discourse of development that Pierre Pettigrew has is actually a discourse of dependency.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate talking to you.
So, as many of you know, agriculture is the biggest sticking point within the negotiations right now within the WTO. It was the main reason for the failure in Seattle a few years ago. It was the reason why at Qatar 2 years ago, they called it the development round, largely because of the developing countries' complaints around what the agriculture negotiations, where they were going. And it's really the weakest point within the WTO. I mean, it's likely to be, if there's one thing that's going to stop the WTO negotiations from moving forward in Cancun this year, it's going to be it's going to be a few things, but agriculture is going to be one of the big ones for sure. And it looks like, by all accounts right now of NGOs that follow this stuff, like that, it's slated towards failure right now. It's certainly the biggest worry for Pettigrew and all of the other trade ministers, especially from the developed countries. And it's one of the main reasons for assembling this week in Montreal to get past some of these barriers. So that's why it's important to talk about. To start off, capitalism has its roots in agriculture. A lot of people know that. The enclosure movement in England was a way of disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of people from their land, removing their means of production, which they were somewhat autonomous. They might not have owned the land, but it was a way of making their living and surviving through enclosure acts, which were legal. It's legislation from the government. Land was privatized. People were no longer able to cultivate either the common lands or the lands that they'd been, you know, using for survival for generations. And these people became, their labor became the force that fueled the Industrial Revolution. So that's a very nutshell overview of the enclosure movement. But it's really important because that nutshell is still going on today. We still have peasants around the world. There's 3.1 billion people around the world that live on the land. And a lot of those people are producing a lot of their own products, a lot of their own survival. You know, people talk about, well, $1 a day. People don't actually survive off that $1 a day. They survive with that $1 a day. But they also are doing lots of stuff outside the market economy as well. So that $1 a day kind of is a very narrow way of measuring the economy. I mean, it's definitely poverty, and I think that it's problematic, but at the same time, it's a very narrow way I won't go into that too much, but a lot of people have heard, you know, GDP is not a way of measuring the wealth and of a culture or population. So during the enclosure movement, colonialism was well underway around the world. It was a system of mercantilism, kings, queens moving around their armies to bring as many raw products back, silver and gold. The idea being for the nation to have as much silver and gold bullion as possible. With the beginning of capitalism, that started to change. It was much more about trade and wealth between commerces, not the actual wealth of the kingdoms. And the model of industrialization in Britain, where people were removed from the land and moved into industry, soon became the model for development. And it still remains, as I said before, kind of the model all throughout 50s, 60s, and 70s. And still, the World Bank is promoting this sort of, well, we need to get people out of the countryside and into the factories, and that's how economies grow. In terms of the role of capital in shaping agriculture systems, there's a lot of problems. Agriculture has always been a pretty big obstacle. At the beginning, it wasn't an obstacle for capital. It was a way of capitalists, of owners of means of production to increase their wealth through this, like through coercion, using the state, using armies. But later on, there's a lot of obstacles. It's difficult to organize agriculture in kind of your stereotypical capitalist economic framework. First of all, land, which is the main means of production, is very capital intensive. You can't just like, it's a high in value. It's you can buy a whole bunch of it, but it can be pretty risky. I mean, certainly the best way to get land if you want to create like a factory in the fields is through war and coercion and using the state to get it for you for free, like what's going on in Iraq or Afghanistan or other places. Another thing that's an obstacle for capital in terms of agriculture is labor issues. Labor is in agriculture is very seasonal, and capitalism relies on a very steady workforce that's always there. And so it's difficult to get a whole bunch of labor all in one spot for a short period of time. And then, they, you know, that's why you have, like, migrant labor moving around often from crop to crop to crop. Thirdly, agriculture is a risky business for capital for investment. Capitalists don't want to invest because it's if the weather goes bad, you're shot, your profits are shot, and you never really know. And fourth, a lot of the means of production are reproducible biologically, naturally, in the hands of the farmers. And that's a huge barrier. And that's one of the main barriers that capital right now, and for the last 100 years, has been trying to get around. So in terms of replacing the natural fertility with fertilizers, instead of farmers and nature producing the soil fertility naturally, you have fertilizers. Instead of using integrated pest management, so having lots of a diversity of insects and diversity of plants that repel negative the pests that destroy the crops, you have pesticides. Instead of having seed that is reproduced by the farmer and replanted every year, you have seed that cannot be reproduced every year because it's either hybrid seed, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later on, or because there's a patent on it, or because in the future maybe there'll be Terminator technology, which is like sterile. It's been bred through biotechnology to be sterile. So these are all ways that capital tries to penetrate the agriculture system, but still it's too risky, and we've ended up, even after 300 years of capitalism in Western societies, having this weird thing where we have millions of individual producers who actually own their means of production, instead of having like large integrated farms. I mean, we have a bit of that in like California and other places, and certainly more in the US than in Canada, but largely agriculture is still in the hands of independent producers. It's sort of like the artisanal, to the extent that the workers own the land, they own some of the means of production. A lot more and more of it is being bought from companies, but and that's because of these barriers. And these barriers are, in the opinion of, well, in the hopes of capitalists, like penetratable. And the idea of replacing these natural forces, these means of production in the hands of farmers with products and with commodities, is synonymous with development, right? Like, development is when everything's going to be traded on the market and will have an economic value. That's what's going to add to the GDP, and that's how development is normally measured. So everything that's nature is up for auction, basically. It's up for commodification. Also, so is every human activity, right? So all the processes. And just to help reinforce this, I guess, when I'm talking about, I'm talking mostly about agriculture, but we could easily be talking about the whole food system, and we should be really talking about the whole food system, everything from the seed to the plate, because we have all these human activities involved in eating and producing and sharing food, right? Like, all of our knowledge about nutrition, all of the meals that we cook with people around the table, all of these human activities that occur without the market, like, deciding for us, are also up for commodification, integration into the market system, into commodities. So that's why we have more and more like health foods, right? You have to go and buy your special nutrients. You have to, like, soon we'll have biotech food that'll have like more vitamin A, and, you know, like, as if we didn't already have all the knowledge and all that. That's the market taking away our knowledge and taking away the processes that are under our control right now and putting it in the hands of companies that can make a profit off of it. So to take the surplus value off of products that are the processes that are already ongoing. A brief quote: to maintain capitalism, it has to constantly expand, right? Like, it has to expand. That's the only way it can survive. And the way to survive is to impose these new commodity forms in our lives, right? So when we talk about globalization, it's somewhat accurate because there's new markets and there's new people and there's new resources that can be exploited and commodified around the world. But I think it's much better to talk about, well, we could talk about capitalist globalization, but parallel to that is just capitalist expansion in general, because it happens here. It doesn't just happen like in new parts of the world. And it happens at a smaller and smaller scale as genes and our dinner tables and all the things that that are smaller than, I don't know, in like large industry become commodified. And so I'll get to a bit more of that. I guess I have to step back a little bit into theory, because I'm going to talk about the theory behind free trade for a second, which is a a lot of people know about this, but I'll try to go over it fairly quickly. Comparative advantage, that's sort of the main idea behind free trade, free trade in general, but free trade in agriculture in particular. The idea of comparative advantage is that each region is going to produce whatever it can, whatever it's most efficient at producing, okay? And I'm going to get into like a lot of talking about how we measure efficiency in a second. So the idea is, yeah, it's presented as it's more efficient, therefore it's going to be things are going to be cheaper to produce and cheaper to buy in the end. It'll be good for everybody. That's generally the way it's talked about. And in some cases, it's true. But to really analyze this and to really debunk it, we have to step a little bit back, I think. The theory of comparative advantage actually came up at the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution. David Ricardo, who's like the guy who came after Adam Smith in terms of the theory of the free market. He was a much larger asshole than Adam Smith on a number of levels. Ricardo observed that while workers and landlords consume their incomes, capitalists accumulate and invest. Such investment patterns create conditions that lead to growing populations, but within the context of limited resources and finite domestic markets that constitute constraints to growth, constraints that can only be alleviated by technological progress and international trade. And you'll see technological progress and international trade are the two kind of main themes of this workshop. His famous example that's still taught in macro, although I've never taken macroeconomics, but I think it's still taught in 101, is this example of England and Portugal in producing cloth and wine. Okay, so just I'll try to go through it pretty quick. These are hypothetical numbers, but he said, okay, assumption number one is that in England, it would cost 100 hours of work to produce a bolt of cloth, like a meter of cloth or whatever it is, and 120 hours to produce a barrel of wine. In Portugal, it would cost 90 hours to produce the same bolt of cloth and 80 hours to produce the same barrel of wine. In other words, Portugal is more efficient for both cloth and wine. And Portugal has the absolute cost advantage in both commodities. However, both nations would benefit if Portugal produced only the wine that it's more efficient at, and England produced only the cloth that it's more efficient at, and they traded. He had a number of reasons why this would help the overall economy. Sorry, yeah. It basically breaks down to, since Portugal is more efficient at producing wine than cloth, and England is more efficient at producing cloth than wine, then those two countries should specialize in the things that they're most efficient at. And efficient, I'm always going to do a little because it greatly depends on how you measure efficiency. And I'm going to give a lot of modern examples to illustrate this in a second, so it should become a little bit more clear. But there's three problems with this. There's three main problems with this argument. One, on a philosophical level and sort of democratic level and cultural level, why would we want to make all our decisions based on efficiency, right? Like, there's a lot of other values that we have as a society than how many hours of labor it's going to take to produce something. Like, I mean, I don't do always... sometimes I do things that are the most efficient, but for sure, and efficiency is important, but there's a number of other values and things that are important to societies and around the world, and I'll get to some more examples of that. I'm going to use these three problems of this argument a few times in the modern examples. Second, efficiency gets calculated in the most bizarre and screwed up ways. And efficiency is almost always defined by whoever's got the most power within the discussion. Okay, so in the modern case, the WTO, efficiency is basically determined by technocrats and bureaucrats from Europe and the U.S. I'll get to more of that in a second. Third of all, there's enormous corruption in terms of who the players are within this economy. The other less famous example to do with Ricardo's example is it was true, Portugal did start producing wine, and England was producing cloth, but it was actually English merchants who controlled the Portuguese trade market, the wine exporting market. So it wasn't actually Portugal that was making the money. It was actually all these profits were going back to England. So this very convenient, this theory was very convenient in terms, I don't know if Ricardo had a particular interest in it, but I'm sure his friends did, in terms of making the money off of these calculations of what was most efficient. The WTO uses the Agreement on Agriculture as its main way of calculating this comparative advantage and establishing a system of maximum efficiency within international markets. The idea is to get rid of all the barriers to these calculations of comparative advantage becoming reality. Okay, and there's a number of ways that countries use protectionist measures to privilege domestically produced commodities over commodities that are coming in from abroad. It can be through import tariffs, so putting a tax on all products that are entering the country. It can be on subsidies to farmers. It can be on subsidies, a whole bunch of different types of domestic subsidies, which the WTO's got like 100 definitions of. I'll get into a little bit as well in a second. It could be environmental legislation. It could be health legislation. It could be cultural legislation. All of these things could be different reasons for having certain barriers for foreign markets that are produced cheaper to come into the country. So in principle, the idea in the WTO and the economists were involved at the very beginning with the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is the predecessor of the WTO, this is their main goal in life, is to get rid of this, get rid of protectionism. The only protectionist measures that will be allowed, supposedly, are farmer income supports. That's payments directly to farmers that are not related to production. Okay, so it's just basically the government paying farmers to be farmers. The most recent European Common Agricultural Policy, which is the European Union negotiates as a bloc, right? So that was their most recent decision, was to just use that as a way of supporting their farmers instead of, that's not entirely true, but to majorly cut down on subsidies that were going towards production, which were causing a glut in the market. There'd be a huge surplus of all kinds of European products. So they're cutting down a little bit on that, but not significantly. Other things that are allowable under the WTO, or that will be allowable if the Agreement on Agriculture moves forward, are food security payments. And this is interesting. It's kind of weird. You'd think that supporting your local food bank, the government supporting food banks in their countries and other kinds of food security measures is the best way of fighting hunger. But actually, I think it needs to continue, but it can actually, there's so much like food stamps program in the U.S. and other U.S.-funded food security programs come up to a total of $2 billion a year. That's a hell of a lot more than most developing countries have for all their agricultural subsidies. So you can, so that money, I mean, it's going indirectly through consumers to retailers back into the agriculture system. But you can see how these kinds of domestic policies can actually subsidize the agriculture system in a particular country and cause a glut in the market as well. Other things that are allowable are roads and infrastructure. So the U.S. can invest as much as it wants in railroads, U.S., Europe, Canada, any other country, but no other countries can afford it nearly as much. Roads, all this infrastructure can be subsidized basically indefinitely or unlimited, and that's all allowable. And finally, marketing. So marketing U.S. products, marketing Canadian products, that's another way of subsidizing your agriculture system. That's allowable under the Agreement on Agriculture. All four of these are only affordable by developed countries, okay? So the only allowable subsidies for agriculture are affordable by rich countries. That's a really important thing to remember in terms of how the agreement is slated towards the richer countries. So to get into a couple of examples, NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. signed it in like 92. It went into effect in 94. Is one of the most in-depth free trade agreements in the world, and it's a great example of how free trade undermines farmers, consumers, agriculture systems, ecosystems, everything to do with agriculture and food. And again, I'm going to go back to those three problems with Ricardo's argument of comparative advantage to talk about NAFTA, okay? So the three were philosophically and democratically and culturally messed up to use measures of efficiency to determine our livelihoods and food systems. Second, the way it's calculated is totally unfair, the way efficiency is calculated. And third, corruption, okay? So philosophically, I mean, and democratically, there's a whole number of things that could be mentioned under NAFTA. The comparative advantage, I'll just give a very brief overview of, is we're supposed to produce pigs and corn, right? That's the mega Bolshevik. That was in 98. The government got together with the most powerful farmers' federations in Quebec and decided that we should produce pigs as our comparative advantage here. I won't go into the details of that. A lot of people know about that, and we can talk about it later if you want. So philosophically, the problem with this, at least in Mexico, is that corn is like the basis of life. Corn originates in Mexico, right? There's thousands and thousands of varieties of corn that are still grown by peasants who have been developing these varieties for literally thousands of years. It's their lifestyle. Corn is synonymous with life to a certain extent with a lot of campesinos. Flooding the markets with U.S. corn, which can be produced a hell of a lot cheaper, is going to destroy this traditional lifestyle and a lot of the culture of Mexico, both in cities and in rural areas. There's a whole bunch of other ones. We could talk about examples in the U.S. And Canada as well in terms of all the other values associated with agriculture and food that will be just trumped with comparative advantage. Second of all, how comparative advantage gets calculated. So the economics of it are totally bunk. You can't compare agriculture systems in the U.S. and Mexico. They're so different. There's such a different history. Comparative advantage, I mean, the free market and liberalism and neoliberalism in general assume they're totally ahistorical. They don't accept that different places have different histories and that things happen in uneven ways over time. They just assume that everyone's always starting at exactly the same place. But the U.S. has grown up with a very protectionist agriculture. That's how it became what it is today. It was heavily subsidized for, you know, its first 200 years. And, I mean, it still is very drastically subsidized. It's not a level playing field, which is the metaphor that's always used by the free trade people to talk about everyone has to compete fairly, right? As I said, it's highly mechanized. It's had 100 years of mechanization that a lot of places in Mexico haven't had. Huge government support for research and development of the varieties that it supposedly has a comparative advantage over. So totally, lots of use of state resources, public resources for that. Excuse me. And not to mention all the subsidies that keep on coming in that go directly to farmers, okay? So corn farmers get 30 times more than their Mexican counterparts in subsidies. 30 times. Like, you can't compete on that. That's not... I mean, even if it was desirable to have a system of level playing field, maximum efficiency, it's not anywhere close to that. So the fact that they get 30 times more, some corn farmers receive 42% of their income in government subsidies in the U.S., which basically are just going through the farmer straight to the corporation, right? So straight to the companies that are providing the seed, chemicals, tractors, which are often... could often be one company, right, that supplies all of these things. In the end, you have corn being sold for $2.28 a bushel, which is the international price, the comparative advantage price, which is actually costing $3.41 to grow in the U.S. So it's being sold at two-thirds of its production cost, which is totally against the idea of the market or comparative advantage. And that $3.41 does not even include the costs that are ecological, the costs that are hidden. There's a million hidden costs within the economy. So you can see why corn is now starting to flood the markets in Mexico, according to the... I mean, and okay, I'll get to why why the U.S. wants this, which is the third argument against comparative advantage, is that you have this immense level of corruption in terms of who the players are that are organizing these free trade agreements. NAFTA was basically drafted by the largest players in the corn. The agriculture agreement in NAFTA was basically drafted by the corn transnationals, okay? Archer Daniels Midland is the largest exporter of corn in the world. They have a strategic partnership with Maseca, which is a corn flour company. You can buy their stuff at like supermarkets here, the corn flour. They control 70% of the corn flour market in Mexico, which is what you make tortillas from, right? 70% is like way, way, way beyond monopoly. That's extreme. Carlos Salinas, who signed NAFTA for Mexico, has very strong connections to Maseca. His brother's in jail for murdering a governor who opposed the construction of a Maseca flour processing plant. Okay, Salinas is well renowned as like one of the most corrupt politicians in the world. He actually lives in Ireland right now because he had to get away from prosecution. Brian Mulroney, who signed for Canada, is on the board of directors of Archer Daniels Midland. He joined the year after the year that NAFTA went into effect. Okay, I mean. It's quite clear the connections of who's in power, how these agreements get drafted, and how they get pushed through. So that's the analogy with Ricardo's argument is the fact that it was the British who controlled the wine exporting industry in Portugal who wanted this specialization in order. The more specialized things are, the more concentrated they are, the easier they are to control for few players. So the end result of this, the end result came a lot faster. The NAFTA's agreement on the NAFTA chapter on agriculture was supposed to be eased in over 15 years. Every 5 years, there was supposed to be a few new commodities that were liberalized. Corn was actually not supposed to be liberalized until 2006, but basically right away, corn started flooding the markets, largely through food aid, which is not nearly as benign as a lot of people think. Food aid is a very political and very strategic process that is largely also controlled by companies. Low interest loans would be offered to buy American corn, and that's one way of just totally destroying the market for corn within Mexico. So like the tariffs were supposed to remain on corn, were supposed to remain at 200% for those 15 years, but they were basically never applied starting 1994. Since then, 600 peasants in Mexico, at the rate now, is 600 peasants lose their land every single day. Okay, that comes to 108 million jobs in rural areas lost since 1994. Supposedly, these lower costs get translated into cheaper consumer products. In reality, the cost of a typical food basket in Mexico has doubled within all of this. Okay, so, I mean. The idea is, yeah, the free market economy is good for everybody. It's good for producers and consumers. That's bullshit. It's never the case that costs actually get reduced.
The Montreal meetings serve as a pre-summit for the September Cancun rounds of trade negotiations. These meetings are a desperate attempt to go on with business as usual at the WTO, despite the disagreements within the organization and the massive show of dissent around the world expressed to WTO policy. The popular mobilization against the WTO in Montreal is one of a series of mass demonstrations against the WTO. At the Battle of Seattle, November 1999, protesters succeeded in shutting down the Millennium Round Ministerial. The WTO retreated to Qatar to avoid another embarrassment in 2001, but direct resistance has continued at subsequent mini-ministerials in Sydney and Tokyo. Opposition to the WTO neoliberal agenda will continue to take to the streets as the voices you've heard here are excluded from the table. Stay tuned for more reports throughout this mobilization from Rock the WTO Radio, an initiative of indie media activists converging in Montreal. For more information, please visit rock-the-WTO-radio.tactic.org. That's rockthewtoradio.tactic.org.
thoughts, it's a part of my mission to break down the vision. Mental compartment, psychological poisons. I will be sowing the seeds of community, accommodating every colour, every need. So listen to my message and heed my warning. I'm telling you now how and when it waits.